Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's almost eerie, right? The fact that on the third anniversary of Katrina, there's another storm aiming for the Gulf Coast. So far, so good. Crude fell today despite worries over the oil rigs in the Gulf. By all accounts, FEMA and the Red Cross are more ready now than the last time. And nobody else is taking any chances. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday. It is the 29th of August today. Gustav is a hurricane again after weakening a bit over Haiti and Jamaica. The storm is now expected to make landfall sometime Tuesday morning, somewhere between Mobile Bay and the Texas-Louisiana border. New Orleans, of course, is right near the middle of that broad area. So we've called Tom LaGrange, he runs the Port of New Orleans, to see what kind of preparations he's making and to ask what happens if the storm does hit. Mr. LaGrange, good to talk to you.
Hey, good to be with you today.
How's your stress level today, sir?
Well, it's about normal hurricane stress level, not any different than Katrina. Things have been happening for 2 or 3 days in terms of preparations for, you know, a worst-case scenario, landfall. But from the state level on down, it seems to be a lot more organization, a lot more concern, and people are more organized and confident.
Give us the 30-second primer on what happens if you have to shut that port down. What happens to the rest of the economy?
Well, it's not good because, as you know, 62% of the consumer spending public of the United States is served through the gateway here at the Port of New Orleans. 380,000 jobs in America as a result of it. At the end of the day, if the Mississippi River here at the Port of New Orleans closes, it's a detrimental economic impact of $275 million a day to the economy of the nation. And that grows exponentially after the fourth day because of the law of supply and demand.
How long do you figure it'll take you to open things back up if you get a moderate storm in or near New Orleans?
Well, we're hoping within a day or two. In the case of Katrina, we were open 12 days following the storm.
Remind us what's in those container ships that go up and down the Mississippi through the port.
Oh, everything from Fruit of the Loom underwear to Spalding basketballs and footballs, Nike running shoes, electronics equipment, televisions, computers, clothing, textile goods.
Characterize the preparations for me this time. Would you say you're better prepared this time?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we began preparations in earnest actually 2 or 3 days ago, and I think it was done almost in the pretense of a fire drill, if you will. Just checks and double checks and rechecks, you know, particularly with our IT people, communications being the big factor that we had a problem with after Katrina. You couldn't find a cell phone anywhere that worked. So this time we have out-of-state cell phone numbers that aren't in jeopardy of being damaged or malfunctioning as a result of the storm. Our IT system has a backup, and a backup to that backup now. And so just a lot better preparation.
What's your indicator? What's your trigger for shutting things down?
I think the main indicator is at a point in time when the hurricane hits the Gulf and we're relatively assured that it's taking dead aim, or we're within not only the cone, but within the actual real models, they're called, the real models that are projected to take landfall anywhere near New Orleans, it would be at that point. Or the alternate would be if the governor says there's a mandatory evacuation, get out, then at that point is when we would pull the trigger.
Gary LaGrange is the president and CEO of the Port of New Orleans, Louisiana. Mr. LaGrange, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
You're welcome, Kai. Have a good weekend.
The country's biggest cable company did something remarkable today. Comcast set an official limit on how much bandwidth its customers can use. 250 gigabytes a month is the formal cap. For a little context here, that's about 100 times what the average Comcast subscriber uses. And once the policy takes effect in October, customers who top that limit could have their service suspended if they don't change their ways. But Marketplace's Dan Gretsch explains cap isn't really about the internet anyway. It's about television.
How much is 250 gigabytes? It's about 50 million emails, 62,000 songs, 25,000 photos. In other words, far more bandwidth than the average web surfer currently uses. Comcast says it enacted the cap to weed out excessive users. Derek Turner is with Free Press, a nonprofit that has complained to the FCC about the way Comcast manages its network. He says the cap is really the cable company's response to high-definition video over the Internet.
That is a direct threat to Comcast's core business model and their core cash cow, which is delivering video.
250 gigs translates to downloading just 25 HD movies. Turner says Comcast capping Internet use is a case of the fox guarding the hen house.
The same pipe they use to deliver video is used to deliver Internet. And as more and more content is available online, I think customers are quickly going to realize that they don't need to pay cable companies $100 a month to get their video content.
Comcast would not make any officials available on air. Om Malik writes the influential tech blog GigaOm.com. He says the era of a flat fee for unlimited Internet use may be coming to an end.
It is going to encourage other broadband providers to do what Comcast is doing.
Time Warner Cable, the nation's second largest cable operator, is testing a system that charges Internet subscribers based on use. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Some county officials in Alabama got taken out to the woodshed today. Wall Street is more than a little concerned over Jefferson County's mountain of debt. Back in the mid-1990s, the county issued more than $3 billion worth of bonds to pay for a new sewer system. But now those loans might end up dragging Jefferson, which includes Birmingham, the state's biggest city, down into the gutter. From WBHM in Birmingham, Andrew Yeager reports.
6 years ago, the county swapped its sewer bonds for variable and auction rate securities. When the subprime mortgage mess hit, the county's interest payments went from a trickle to a gusher. Betty Fine Collins is president of the county commission.
We've had nothing but just situations that have worsened almost daily. So we certainly hope that the market will take a turnaround.
But the frozen auction rate securities market shows no signs of thawing. Collins says the county is on the verge of default. County commissioners have been squabbling about what to do since April. Kyle Whitmire covers local government for Birmingham Weekly. He says Alabama Governor Bob Riley stepped in recently and forced the commissioners to find some common ground.
Just to have been a fly on the wall at the Jefferson County Courthouse this past week, it would have been a blast.
Whitmire says the governor is now warning lenders that the county could go bankrupt. That could mean big losses for the banks, which include J.P. Morgan and Bank of America.
They're sort of playing chicken with the banks again now. They're giving the banks and the insurers something to lose. So actually now they have more incentive to come back and negotiate a little bit.
If the county files for protection from its lenders, it'll be the biggest municipal bankruptcy in American history. Some commissioners fear it'll stigmatize the county and make it difficult to borrow in the future. But refusing to file for bankruptcy will be expensive. The penalties and increased interest could push the county's payments up to around $50,000 an hour. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Andrew Yeager from Marketplace.
There was some economic data out today, consumer spending and personal income. Kind of, actually, and Wall Street reflected that. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. It's been a whirlwind 24 hours in the presidential campaign. The big speech by Barack Obama last night at the Democratic Convention in Denver. Then a smaller but equally important speech by Alaska Governor Sarah Palin this morning at a rally in Dayton, Ohio. John McCain gave everybody something to talk about with his choice of Palin as his running mate. And he pretty much guaranteed lots of buzz when the Republicans meet Monday in St. Paul, Minnesota. The GOP has chosen a backdrop for its convention that reflects some of the same economic problems the whole country and the new president are going to have to deal with come January. From Minnesota Public Radio, Annie Baxter reports.
If you know anything about Minnesota, it might be from the public radio program A Prairie Home Companion. The show's host, Garrison Keeler, tells stories about a mythical town called Lake Wobegon. It's a kind of shorthand for Minnesota.
That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average.
For years, Minnesota did earn that above-average standing in areas like high school graduation rates, growth in per capita income, and employment numbers. State economist Tom Stinson is proud of that, but he'll also tell you, maybe a little reluctantly, about Minnesota's big shortcoming, an aging population.
Now, Minnesota is such an exceptional place that you hate to say that it's average in anything, but Minnesota is so average with respect to age structure that it's, well, exceptionally average.
Minnesota's population is getting old, just like the nation's, and that's going to affect the workforce. In this decade and the next, Minnesota officials project that for every 4 newly created jobs in the state, there'll be 9 jobs vacated, largely by retirees. Stinson says workers are going to be in much shorter supply.
These are big problems, and they're not problems specific to Minnesota. Minnesota's economy and the U.S. economy needs to be prepared for really massive changes, changes on a scale in the demographics that we haven't ever seen before that are coming with the retirement of the baby boomers.
In some businesses, the future is already here. This company, Checker Machine, makes components for other companies. Chief Operating Officer Dave Fiedler says lots of Checker's 60 or so workers are nearing retirement, and he's worried.
Well, I have a little chart that I put together for you. You can see our age group from 55 to 65 plus, we have about 32% of our workforce. And so you can see in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to lose the majority of our workforce of talented people. And if you look at the top of the chart, 20 to 30-year-olds are only 6% of our workforce.
Fiedler wants the government to beef up school instruction so that high school grads can do the math and programming that Checker Machine work requires. But Fiedler's also offering older workers part-time work to retain them. And he's got a training program to recruit workers. Business leaders say retraining of adult workers is critical to the future workforce.
I didn't grow up with a computer.
Trina Joyce is an unemployed social worker in her 50s. During a class break at this Minneapolis Job Resource Center, she said one reason she's out of a job is her lack of computer chops.
I don't have the typing skills or the computer skills, so that's something I need to work on.
Much less skilled workers pass through job centers like this. Some centers are piloting the National Work Readiness Credential. The centers assess workers on reading and math. A coalition of businesses, unions, and state governments wanted to help employers identify qualified talent and give workers a leg up in their interviews. Bill Blazer, a vice president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, says businesses also need better access to immigrant labor. He says many Minnesota business owners, like others nationally, favor a new, more flexible approach.
I think many Minnesota companies would be employing more immigrants if they were confident that they were doing that in compliance with federal and now increasingly state law.
Getting more and better workers ready for work, however you do it, is something that economists and business owners here and around the country say the government needs to prioritize. But with more pressing problems, like inflation and unemployment, we'll see how prominently the future workforce figures in this year's presidential campaigning. In St. Paul, I'm Annie Baxter from Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. We're going to do something different this week, David, I think. It's going to be not the week, but maybe the last 19 years, huh?
It's been a long 19 years on Wall Street, or at least with Marketplace, and it's been a lot of fun. But it's probably time to, you know, I think I've run out of BS. I think that's what it is.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's play the first day's worth of BS. I went into the archives, dug out the tape. Here's what you sounded like 19 years ago.
It's been said that bull markets climb a wall of worry. And if that's true, then the wall went back up for investors this week.
I have to tell you, I laughed so hard when I heard that tape because I don't know how many times I've heard you use the phrase "climb the wall of worry."
Well, at least I'm consistent. 1989. You know what the Dow was in 1989?
25, 26 is probably.
Yeah. I mean, it has come a long way. Back then, we were, you know, we'd only hoped to get up to about 200 million shares a day in trading. And now a normal day is 1.5 billion shares a day. A lot's changed.
Are we smarter for all that change? I mean, there are a lot more people in the market.
Yeah, there are a lot more people in the market now. They're a lot savvier, too. I think one of the reasons we started doing this show, I think, or at least I started doing my segment, was a lot of people were forced into the market. They really, it wasn't greed that brought them in there. Is they were having to manage their own 401ks, and you had to have some sort of knowledge about what was going on. They really didn't want to do it. Then, you know, you got on into the 90s, and boy, then greed took over and conquered fear, and everybody wanted to be in, and they were looking for the next Microsoft or Netflix or Amalgamated Sprinkle Works or whatever.
That's right. And that's why we had you on the program, and we needed a guy who did this for a living, who knew what it was like on those trading floors, and we called you when we needed help. And we needed help on the 11th of September, 2001, just like everybody else did. David Brancaccio, who used to host this program, called you up that day and asked you about your clients and what you were telling them.
I had a lot of clients that we talked to, and most of them realized that there's not a lot to do right now. Most of them wanted some quiet assurance that the system works and that we'll get through this. And I assured them with what I truly believe, which is that the system does work and we'll get through this.
You still believe that?
Oh, sure. But see, that's why, you know, one of the raps on me, and I love defending it, is that I'm always optimistic and it's rose-colored glasses, you know. But the fact is, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years, and we have been through a lot. I mean, that crash of 87 was about as spooky as I've ever seen. And I watched the Arab oil embargo, and gasoline tripled. And we had to stand in line to buy it, and most of the time couldn't get it. And we came through it, and we were fine, and we kicked ourselves for not buying stuff when it was cheap. And I knew, I didn't know how we were going to come through 9/11, but I knew we were going to come through it. It always works out.
You know, that's not bad. I'm going to use that the next time somebody complains to me about you always having rose-colored glasses. Listen, be good.
I will, and I will miss you guys. Working with you has been fabulous, and David Brancaccio and David Brown and Jim Angle, and having good, bright, intellectual people that you can have a dialogue with and throw away the script with.
That's right. You and me shooting the breeze on a Friday afternoon. David Johnson, down in Dallas, Texas, one last time. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Kai.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials traded down almost 1.5% today, 171 points to close at 11,543. The NASDAQ plunged 1.8%, 44 points, finished at 2367, the NASDAQ did. The S&P 500 lopped off 1.3%, 17 points, ended the day at 1282. For the week, the Dow fell 0.7%, the NASDAQ carved off 2%. The S&P 500 gave back 0.7%. Dell's gloomy profit report sent tech stocks reeling. Number two PC maker lost almost 14%. Intel chipped off 3%. Microsoft and Cisco Systems each faded more than 2% today as well. Oh, you know it couldn't last. The winning streak is over for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. After running up solid gains all week, the two mortgage finance giants both tumbled close to 14% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence. Online at SaveAndInvest.org. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. U.S. markets are closed for Labor Day, one of just 9 weekdays out of the year you can't trade. Thousands are expected in St. Paul, Minnesota for the start of the Republican National Convention. And at high noon in Nome, Alaska, the Great Bathtub Race takes place. Locals race bathtubs down the street, just like the name implies. Good luck, everyone. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Even though there are another 3 weeks or so until the official end of summer, come on, it's Labor Day weekend, so goodbye beach trips and sidewalk lemonade stands. There is one pastime, though, that we can still enjoy well into the fall, and so we bring you the last of our summer series, Hot Jobs.
We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave.
There's about a month left in baseball's regular season. Then we've got the playoffs and the World Series, too. We're talking the major leagues here. But the minors have a long, hard season, too. To see what the world was about, we went to Portland, Oregon to see the play-by-play.
The 2-1 pitch. Amber swings, drives one toward the gap in right center. Going back is Sadler. Going back is Ramirez. The ball hits the base of the fence.
My name's Rich Burke. I'm the radio and TV play-by-play announcer for the Portland Beavers, the AAA affiliate of the San Diego Padres.
And today, under bright blue skies here at PGE Park, Portland opens up their only series this year with the Astros AAA affiliate, the Round Rock Express.
Baseball's like a play where even the actors don't know the outcome. The worst team in the league could be playing the best team in the league. And in baseball, you just don't know. You can still win that day.
Pitch popped up on the right side. Foul ground. House is there. He has it. And the side retired. The Beavers get a run on Chip Ambers.
Most guys in my industry grew up turning the sound down on the television and practicing play-by-play. I never did that. Matter of fact, the thought of being a play-by-play announcer never crossed my mind. I grew up in Southern California listening to Vin Scully almost every game, hanging on every word he said, not because I pictured myself in his seat, but because I was interested in how the Dodgers were doing. I did play baseball. I played 4 years of college baseball, and even after that was done, I had the dream of playing professionally still, even though there wasn't much market for a slow-footed first baseman with no arm and a guy who had sinking line drives and had no power.
Bases loaded, one down. Antonelli, a right-hand hitter. Miller, the right-hander, delivers. Antonelli swings and lines one. Caught it short.
Obviously, I'm the Beavers broadcaster, and so I'm a fan of the team. I travel with the guys. You can tell who I'm pulling for, not so much by what I say, but by the tone of my voice. So if I say, line drive, base hit, left field, you can tell that's probably for the other team. If I say, line drive, base hit, left field, same words, different inflection, but you can tell who I'm pulling for.
1-2 pitch, swung on, drive toward left center, long run for Abercrombie, jumps and makes the catch, and now drops the ball. McAnulty scores, Ambrose held, the throw coming in from Ramirez.
I just think it's awesome being out here. I think I have the best job on the planet. I've been close to getting big league jobs here and there, and yes, I'd like one, but in the meantime, I don't think there's any better place to be. During the seventh inning stretch, I not only get to sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but I get to throw out peanuts and Cracker Jack.
Peanuts, Cracker Jack, yeah!
We play 144 games in 152 days. And yeah, I need a little bit of a break after the season ends, but about 4 days later, I'm ready to go again. Let's play some more ball.
Mitchell Hartman helped us out with that report. You can see a picture of Rich Burke on our website. It's marketplace.org. San Francisco is definitely not the place to be this week if you're looking for a quick bite. Yeah, there will be places that will slap something onto your plate or into a bag that you can gulp down on the fly later on. But this weekend, the city's hosting something called Slow Food Nation, a celebration of locally grown food and sustainability. A lot of those local farms rely on subscriptions to keep themselves in business, selling produce mostly. But a handful are experimenting with a new way to boost profits, meat. From San Francisco, Lauren Summer has more.
Come on in.
Tamar Adler spends most of her time cooking at Berkeley's famed Chez Panisse restaurant. But lately, her San Francisco apartment has become a hub for a new kind of food distribution service.
It's 6 pigs, 14 lambs, and 2 cows. I mean, it's over 1,000 pounds each month.
Adler runs a community-supported agriculture group in the Bay Area. These groups are fairly common. Members pay a subscription fee and get monthly deliveries of organic fruits and vegetables from nearby farms. But Adler's group is different. It's all about meat.
Okay, what do you have? You have lamb riblets, which are super wonderful. Bone-in pork chops. And then you have chicken and eggs.
This chicken has the head on it.
Yes, it has the head and the feet on it.
The group buys from small farms and ranches that raise animals the old-fashioned way, outdoors, and more humanely, says Wendy Kasanovich, a member of the Bay Area group.
You know, a bad day is a bad day, like being killed
to be eaten is a bad day. Right. But other than that, I'd like you to have a piggy, goaty, lammy life.
Kasanovich and other members say they joined the group to get high-quality meat and at the same time form a personal connection to the food they eat. Adler says the response to her service has been overwhelming. The group developed a waiting list almost immediately, but she's also been getting calls from meat producers, eager to reach more customers.
One of the biggest problems is that actually demand outstrips supply by a good margin. Not because there aren't people producing, because there aren't people producing on a scale that puts them on the radar.
One small producer looking for some attention is Clark Summit Farm, about an hour north of San Francisco.
Hello, chickens.
Dan Bagley runs the farm with his wife, Liz. All of Bagley's cows, pigs, and chickens are raised outdoors on organic feed, and that adds up.
It's a lot more expensive to raise animals this way. Just raising these birds up costs us $10,000 before they even lay an egg.
Bagley sells most of his meat and poultry at local farmers markets. But a few months ago, the farm founded its own community-supported agriculture group.
The nice thing with the CSA is people will pay up front for their 3 months of meat. And it makes it nice when you know you have customers waiting for your products.
By getting paid in advance, Bagley and his wife can rely on a steady stream of income. That helps a lot, given rising food and energy prices.
Yeah, we feel the crunch. Fuel and corn and grain and everything costs so much to produce now.
Those expenses aren't likely to get any cheaper, but Dan Bagley hopes his subscriber service will help him turn a profit. Other farmers are also getting into the game. There are now over 2,000 CSAs nationwide, double the number 4 years ago. In San Francisco, I'm Lauren Sommer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, another data point for you about the Port of New Orleans. Among the biggest exports out the Mississippi River, American chickens going to Russia. For the time being, anyway. Today, Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin banned chicken imports from 19 major American manufacturers. Russia, it turns out, is the biggest export destination for U.S. poultry producers. It's a $1 billion market for them. Putin said the 19 firms he banned hadn't passed the necessary inspections. And that, on this Friday afternoon, is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dipped 171 points, 1.5%. NASDAQ clipped off 44 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 ticked down 17 points, that's 1.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up on Monday, a chocolate taster shares the secret to a perfect bite.
You just stop any movement with the mouth, close your eyes, and concentrate.
It's easy, right? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.